It was the dawn of the third age of podcasting, 12 years after the B5 premiere. The Babylon podcast was a dream given form, its goal to discuss Babylon 5 episodes, arcs, and implications, to interview the cast and crew about their experiences and memories. It's a home away from home for fanboys, geek girls, and lurkers. It can be a silly place, but it's our last best hope for B5 fans. This is the podcast about the story of the last of the Babylon stations. The year is 2006. The name of this show is the Babylon Podcast.
Welcome back to another Babylon Podcast. I am Summer Brooks.
I'm Tim Callender.
Merry Koshmas.
Merry Koshmas, okay.
Hey guys, it's Jeffrey. This week I'm calling you from the lovely town of Sherman Oaks, California. Sherman Oaks, named, of course, after the famous Sherman Oaks, which aren't famous. I made that up. That's total bullshit, so just run with me, okay?
That's why I was going with the standard,
It's the season, and I think you've been seasoning the eggnog, haven't you?
It's only eggnog.
Right.
Yeah. Should we start off with a little Lost Tales news?
Certainly.
Yeah, you got some?
Okay, we received a handful of emails of people passing this on to us. We appreciate that. Keep that coming. But this is from JMS posting up on the web, and it says, as I write this, that is JMS, we have finished principal photography on Babylon 5, The Lost Tales, coming in under budget and finishing a full day ahead of schedule. The first DVD, entitled Voices in the Dark, covers the same 72-hour period of time as Sheridan travels on board a presidential cruiser en route to Babylon 5 for Minbar for a celebration marking the 10th anniversary of the founding of the Interstellar Alliance. One part of the story follows Sheridan as he picks up an unexpected visitor on the edge of Centauri space, Prince Regent Deus Ventari, and a warning about what will come afterward delivered by the technomage Galen. The other part of the story is set aboard Babylon 5 as Colonel Lockley summons a priest from Earth space to deal with a problem that may have dark supernatural overtones. The two parts of the greater story intersect at certain key plot and thematic points so that they overlap and complement each other while telling separate but simultaneous stories. And there was a link for a temporary webpage of photos that were shot by JMS himself. So I don't know, can we link that, Summer, in show notes?
I believe I can link to it. JMS does have a little disclaimer on it asking people not to download them or repost the actual photos anywhere because they're his personal photos. And actually, I think one of our commenters linked to it from comments. But we can put that in the show notes for this show, too.
Okay. So, Jeffrey, got a question for you. It seems to me that it was only recently, and I say, you know, the last handful of months, I guess 2 or 3 months, that it was announced that Lost Tales was going ahead. And now they finished principal photography. Is that normal to do something like that that quickly? Or, you know, am I just showing my ignorance here?
No, absolutely. It always really becomes a case of money. My guess is that these projects are not hugely funded. There's a reason that they're shooting it in Canada. It's because they get more for their money that way. And when you have a low budget, you know, one of the things that just has to happen is you just can't spend weeks and weeks and weeks out there shooting and reshooting and reshooting. And, you know, if you think about it, the business model that we used for Babylon 5 was a 7-day shoot week. You shot an entire episode in 7 days. It's very reasonable that you probably spent more. They probably spent more days in the actual prep and set building and costuming and the various things that they had to do to get ready than the actual time of shooting. That's not uncommon.
Okay. Well, if it gets us DVDs faster, I won't complain too much.
Well, I was going to say the release date is aimed for fall 2007. Now, at that point, given where we are, would you anticipate a lot of time, even more so than what they spent on principal photography, doing post-production and CGI and all that?
Is that release date accurate? They're saying fall now?
That's the last I saw. Now, I could be wrong. It's happened before.
Bummer.
That's not necessarily a bummer. That certainly is the prime time for releasing DVDs because of the Christmas sales rush. So that fall of third or fourth quarter rather of a year is typically when you want to start. For home video, that's the hot season. So that makes sense. My guess is that again with the smaller budget, it's not like they can have an army of people working on post production. They probably only have a few people.
Mm-hmm.
That just, the number of man hours has to get spread out somehow. It requires an X number of man hours to make a show, and you can either do that with 15 guys working for a couple of days or two guys working for a couple of weeks. So, it's all very normal, and that makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Okay.
And I have been frustrated that I have not been able to get Mr. Netter or even JMS, to come talk to us on the Babylon podcast yet. But I will tell you, Tim, that you just reading JMS posts, you do a very good job. You're an excellent substitute.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I also have his hairline, if that makes any difference.
All right. Hey, guys, I have a special guest for us tonight.
Ooh.
Did you know? Did you know?
Ooh.
Uh-huh. So whenever you're ready, we can... You can get Mike. If you wake up Mike and pour him a drink. And have him dial the number.
Okay.
Is it morning yet?
Let's dial those numbers then.
Hello?
Hey, it's Jeffrey.
Hi, Jeffrey.
I want you to meet Tim and Summer. Tim and Summer, Kim Holly, costume supervisor at Babylon 5. Hello, Kim.
Hi, Kim. Hi, Summer.
Hi, Kim. How are you?
Very well. Thank you.
You guys should know that Kim is a pretty darn regular listener to the podcast. We got her hooked back when Wayne Alexander was on. And
really?
We were at a Christmas party this past weekend, and all of a sudden she started to let it slip. I started talking about the podcast to my friends, and all of a sudden Kim starts, blah, 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 blah. She knew all the shows and who was on and what.
Actually, the first one I listened to was Kurt's.
Because
he sent me an old email saying he was doing it. So I was all alone in a hotel room in New Orleans during that time. So, there's something to do tonight. Okay. So I listened to that one, and before I knew it, Wayne was calling me and saying he was doing one. So there you go.
Well, we really appreciate you being here tonight. She had a great idea for me, which was just a little late. Logistically and technically difficult for us because at this party, which is an annual event that many of the B5ers go to, she had suggested that maybe I get all the girls from the wardrobe department together and we have just this round table discussion. I love that concept. It was just a little hard for us to pull off without a little more planning and equipment and time and et cetera. Yeah. So she came to my rescue tonight and wanted to talk to us a little bit about what it was like to work in the wardrobe department and costuming on Babylon 5. Yeah.
Okay.
So what was mostly, it like, let's just talk about the Vorlons.
So was,
oh yes, well I've heard you refer to it the shower curtains several times. I know how you feel about that.
So was that a special shower curtain? I mean, did you have to go and add all the rhinestones and glitter to it, or
extra special? Yes, of course, especially Jeffrey's. To be honest, we actually had very little to do with it. It was mostly the optic nerve design. They did the whole upper body part, and I think the original design probably came from the pilot, which is the one part of Babylon 5 that I did not work on. But the whole extra shower curtain, shall we say, that's the only part we really did in that particular costume.
What was your favorite costume to work on?
My favorite costume? Wow. Mm-hmm. Okay. I would think my favorite costume was probably, I kind of had a soft spot for all of the Centauri emperors.
Ooh.
They were really beautiful fabrics. The first one we got to do was, I don't remember the name of the character, but it
was the first emperor.
Yeah. Well, Turhan Bey was the name of the actor. Yeah. That's what I remembered, but I didn't remember that was what they called him. Is his name? Okay. Anyway, when Anne Bruce, the designer, first came up with that design, I remember thinking it was going to be very nice. And her strong suit, I think, was picking out really amazing fabrics. And she picked this beautiful combination of whites and creams and just these great brocades. And it was just a lot of fun to make, and it just turned out really beautiful. And the combination of him and his court with the ladies and, you know, the whole thing, I remember the first time I saw that scene when he was walking down the hall when he falls down and he's, you know, having his heart attack or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
I just started crying because it just looked so beautiful. And I just thought, that's great. I'm just so glad we're doing these, you know, wonderful things. And then we got to do them again and again and again on all these different actors. And it was nice because then every time she had to go out and find new fabrics and different things. Same idea, but slightly different, a little bit tweaked and, you know, more beautiful fabrics. And that's what I love. So
did some of that idea also go into the costume for Majel Barrett?
Yes, of course. She had a very, very nice costume.
Yes.
All the Centauris and Centauri ladies had really great costumes. And then I was going to say, my first instinct when you asked me my favorite was the Minbaris, and was a lot of Delenn's costumes were very nice too. She had really beautiful stuff in hers. All just really great silks. There was a wonderful store here in Los Angeles that we used to go to buy a lot of the fabrics, and it has since actually gone out of business and sold all their... actually, it happened during the run of the show, and it was a very sad moment here. Yeah.
So what did you do for fabrics after that?
Well, there was other places we went to, and they sold all their stock to another store here. And unfortunately, they took it, and they put a lot of it in storage, so it was difficult to get to. And had to, like, really, you know, talk to them and say, I know that you have this. Take me to your storage room and show me where it is, you know. And there was some of that, and some of it they actually, like, cut in half, like, the lengthwise.
Oh, no.
And sold it for double the price. Because it was amazing fabrics from, like, the 30s and 40s and just really wonderful things, yeah. Anyway.
So what was your least favorite show in the first place?
I'm sorry?
Oh, Jeffrey, go ahead.
I was going to say, so on the other hand, what was your least favorite? Which one kind of let you, which one did you have to throw together that you just never really, yeah.
I don't remember anything. Wow, I don't remember anything we threw together and I didn't like. I can tell you a costume that that was sort of the bane of my existence. And
okay.
That would be the original Earth Force uniforms.
Oh, yes.
They were very, very difficult. They were difficult to wear. I don't think the actors liked them. They were just hard with the combination of the wool and the leather. And again, they were left over from the pilot. And so we were trying to match what someone else had done and yet improve upon it. And they were very, very hard. And trying to make the metals attached to the leather. And, it, you know, it was like I turned out for some reason in the only department to be, in the whole department to be the only person that could, like, sew the metals on properly so they'd stay on. And so I was doing that till odd hours of the night some nights. And, you know, it was just not my favorite costume. We were all very, very happy when the new black uniforms came in. That was a happy moment in the costume department.
Among
the actors.
Did you guys go to Joe and say, write a script where we can get rid of these horrible uniforms?
No, not at all. I don't think so. Anne might have had that conversation with him, the designer, but I don't think it happened quite like that. The actors might have said that to him because they really didn't like him. But I think it just naturally progressed in the show, obviously. And but when it came up in the script, I remember Anne turned to me, we share an office, and said, well, we get to make new uniforms, and she was so excited, and, you know, and she started designing them immediately, and everybody was really happy with the new ones. And, you know, they had their own problems, but not nearly like the blue ones, and they were just, yeah, it was much better.
What kind of turnaround did you have in, okay, here's a design for something, let's go make it because we need to shoot with it on this day?
Well, it varied wildly from, you know, we might have a few weeks, we might have something like the new uniforms. I think she probably knew about, that probably happened in the middle, I want to say around the middle of the third season.
Yes.
And I think she probably knew about it, wow, you're really testing my memory here, but I want to say maybe not at the beginning of the season, but somewhere in between there. You know, she probably had a couple months to work on that and to iron out all the wrinkles and to go through the process of making different designs and getting approved and, you know, all of that, and then getting them all made, obviously. Usually, no matter what it was, you're always down to the last, you know, night before trying to sew on the last tiny details for whoever's working the next day. It just works out that way, no matter what, just because it's always something else to do. And then some costumes, yeah, we would get a script. And the good thing about the show, I have to say, this is the best thing about the show, and I've done a lot of shows and a lot of movies since then, and the best thing is that we always had scripts ahead of time. We always knew what was coming, and Anne probably had a couple, 2 to 3 weeks to sort of figure out what to do and to design. We probably had then that 1 to 2 weeks to actually produce it and make it happen. Rarely, but sometimes, you know, the night before we're sort of, you know, throwing something together for the next day.
So what's it also like when you were doing the, when you have to do so many, like a uniform for a whole bunch of, like in Gropos or a situ, a bunch of Minbari or a bunch of whatever, where you have to crank out a volume of them?
Yeah.
What's that all about?
Again, the producers were really great about giving us a heads up on that kind of thing. Even if we didn't have a full-on script, John Copeland or somebody like that would come to us and say, listen, we're doing an episode, a couple down the line here, where you're going to need to do, you know, 100 of this or 50 of that, or let's start talking about what that is now so you can get started on it. And something like Gropos, for instance, yeah, they gave us warning, we're going to have a whole bunch of Marines, let's figure out what the Marines, I think we already knew what the Marines were because we'd done maybe a handful of them before. So it was like, okay, how can we now do, you know, 150 of them or whatever it was we needed? And literally, because they were based on sort of a flight suit design that we kind of adjusted and changed and added our own little bits to, I contacted a company that makes flight suits, for instance, in San Diego, and talked to them about the possibility of just making them all for us and making them to our specifications, and they did it, and they did it in time. And it was actually less expensive to do it that way than to, you know, have them made by, say, a shop in Los Angeles or something like that. And
Holly, an observation I've had about the show is that as opposed to the uniforms on other science fiction series,
yes,
the cuts were looser. And
yes.
How much of that was with the idea of thinking, you know, if we've got a looser cut on a uniform or a costume, we expand the ability of using particular kinds of actors or extras? Or how much of that was just saying, you know what, we need these bodies in, they may not be, you know, Mr. Universe or Miss America types, and we need to cut a uniform or costume to hide that fact?
Right. That's interesting. Because I almost wouldn't think of it as any of that. I think the original concept, and again, not having worked on the pilot, the original concept, but as I understand it, I think they never wanted that super futuristic, skin tight, as Anne used to put it, why would we ever go there? Why are we in the future ever going to be wearing, you know, spandex jumpsuits? We don't wear them now in our normal run-around life. Well, people in Los Angeles do. But, I mean, outside of that, you know, I mean, what normal person, how is that comfortable? And how does that make you feel, you know, like it comes? So what's realistic about that? And I think that's part of what it was. We didn't want to go to the sci-fi world of, oh, you have to wear rubber or latex or spandex or whatever. We wanted it to be real clothes and real cloth and what people would really wear, and based it on what they wear now. You know, it's only supposed to be, oh boy, see, again, you're testing my memory here. What, a couple hundred years in the future or something? I don't know. It's not a lot in the future. It's not like thousands and thousands, right? I mean, what is it? 500? I don't know.
No, it's about 200.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I remember thinking 200 years in the future. It's not like it's, you know, some weird fantasy 5,000 years from now. I mean, it's, you know, 200 years. What's realistically are people going to be wearing 200 years from now? That was sort of how we looked at it.
Right. One of the things
in terms of the uniforms and that kind of thing. And then coupled with that, certainly we were a smallish show on a, you know, on a cable budget, so shall we say. So certainly making the costumes adjustable for different actors was a thought process that went into it as well at some point.
Well, what I was going to say, one of the observations I had with the show in the costumes, especially with the civilians, collars that were, you know, sort of like, you know, not with lapels or part of the lapel seemed to be removed or whatever. And it seemed to be, you know, like a forward fashion without being, you know, fantastic. And it just always struck me that it was just a couple little things that changed that gave it the right flavor. And that was just very impressive.
That was, Anne Bruce, our designer, who I think is wonderful. That was her idea and her designs, I think, to just kind of take an off-the-rack suit and not say, what can we do to it to make it look, you know, a little different. Not quite of this time, but not so foreign that you go, what, you know, what is that? You know, you want to recognize the person as being from Earth or whatever, you know, 200 years in the future. She took collars off the shirts. I mean, she took lapels, off the jackets or changed them. And, you know, we changed pretty much everything that came in the door. We did buy a lot of things from, you know, Macy's and Bloomingdale's and all the department stores and just tweaked them and just did our own thing and changed the buttons and, you know, did what we could to them. Because there was so much else to do, you know, as far as the aliens and all that. But, you know, when it came to civilian clothes, it was like we couldn't just build everything from the ground up. So that was part of it, too.
What was your first reaction to the show when you got the job?
When I got the job, I was working in theater, as a lot of us were. A lot of us were working at the same theater, actually. a theater here in Southern California, South Coast Repertory. John Iacobelli, their production designer, did a lot of set design at the theater, and he was doing a production there, and as was Anne Bruce. She was doing the costume design, and she and I had known each other for a couple of years working together at the theater off and on. And she was called in and got the job as the costumer on the show, and she, you know, called me and said, listen, I'm doing this, and, you know, would you like to come and do it? And I kind of freaked out a little bit. I was like, I've never done television, film, anything like that. I've only done theater up to that point. And I was a little afraid, and I didn't think I could do it. And she gave me a copy of the pilot, I think, The Gathering, which had already aired. They had already done and aired it by that point. And a lot of the people that I worked with at the theater had worked on it, actually. But I hadn't seen it, and so I watched it, and I was like, wow, this is big. It's a lot. And she said, but we can do this. You know, this is how we do it. And she sat down and explained it to me, how it's not so different from what we normally did. And I said, you know, you're right, we can do this. And that was kind of that. And I was a little afraid, and my beloved at the time talked me into it. Said, yes, you can do this. You should do this. Go ahead. Go for it. So I left a job that I'd had for, like, you know, 12 years and jumped into the industry, as it were.
Okay, so on Babylon 5, what was the strangest costume you had to make or the strangest component of a costume that you had to make?
Strangest?
Like the oddest thing where you would have said, I never would have thought to put that in a costume.
Oh my gosh! Strangest.
I know.
What
about
tell
in
me,
the
Jeffrey.
In the? I think it was in one of the TNT movies where we did that holographic thing, and the guy had like the crazy sex suit that had like.
Oh yeah.
Neon,
that's a good one. That's a good one. Yes, actually, that's a very good one. This guy had this holograph. That probably is it. You're right. And we actually built that in-house. We had a wonderful cutter that made that all happen. Her name is Janet. And, it was this whole thing made out of funny latexy rubber stuff. I hired someone who made it all for me and printed it all for us, and it had tubes and weird things. I don't. It was really bizarre, and it lit up, and it had like a heart, and I couldn't even remember what all it was. But yeah, it was pretty odd. You're right. That was pretty crazy. Yeah. I'm trying to think if there's something else odd that I fit or anything. I can't really think of too many things that were out there. I mean, we do a lot of strange things in theater, so I probably do weirder things in theater than I did in this show, to be honest. Anyway.
Now, listen, the other thing I want to ask you is, it's something I think you brought up at the party the other night. You are always, yeah, I know, alcohol is a great equalizer. You're always very, very good about singing Anne Bruce's praise, as you should be, because she deserves it all. But you quiz me about a Babylon podcast, and I forget who our guest was, but someone was saying that Anne's... Who was that?
You told me, and
Peter.
I listened to it later. Peter, I guess, said that he was like... He was afraid of her.
That's right.
In fact, she was very scary, and then she told him, "You're going to wear this, and that's that." And I just laughed when I read that. And when you told me, because I said, "I don't remember that at all. It's not in my memory."
Well, you have a different theory, don't you?
Well, my theory is he's remembering the designer from the pilot. Who maybe did say that to him. And since I didn't work on the pilot, I don't, again, the movie The Gathering, I don't know her and I don't know what she's like, but that might have happened. But I don't think it happened with Anne. I would be very surprised. My memory of fittings with Peter were very, very sweet and very fun, and he always had a good time. Unless he's like the best actor in the whole world, which is very possible, I don't know. He loved the costumes, always loved having fittings. He and Anne were like great friends and great buddies. And every time we did like new things for him and new vests, and he got all excited and he got to wear his new clothes. And he made it sound like he made us feel like we were just, you know, great. And he just loved what we were doing. So to hear later that, you know, he just did it because he was told, it was a little, I don't know.
Okay, so once again, the podcast sort of sets the record straight.
Well, there you go. Okay.
We pride ourselves on the real inside skinny here.
Yes, anyway.
So how often would a character like Londo get a new wardrobe?
How often? Let's say, gosh, I know he had a purple coat the first year or so. I think he had, I think she made him a navy blue coat, if not in the first season, by the second season. And, you know, she did some tweaking from the pilot to the series. Well, I think what happened is Anne went in and had a meeting with Joe and Straczynski, and they talked about all the things they liked and didn't like from the pilot. And she changed, you know, a few things. And she looked at things. We looked at the stuff from the pilot, and we changed things and decided, you know, this isn't quite working, or it could be better, we could do better, or whatever. And we moved things around and what have you. But as far as how often you get it, I would say he probably got 3 or 4 new vests a year, and that was his main thing. And if he needed new pants, we made new pants. But they were basically black pants, and so, you know, one pair looked like the next pair, so... It was just that he needed it, kind of thing.
So do you have any funny anecdotes of wardrobe malfunctions you can share?
Oh, my gosh, wardrobe malfunctions. I can't think of anything that didn't work right or didn't. I was trying to think of something earlier today when Jeffrey called me. And, again, I haven't had a lot of time to think about this. Things I remember that I liked, though... about related to wardrobe and makeup and all of that. I loved being on the set and then going outside and sitting on the steps. There was always a Narn and a Minbari playing, you know, chess or something. And just sitting there in your way. And then the next
smoking.
Day it would be... Yeah, or smoking and playing... No, not chess. What did they play, Jeffrey?
They played cards and they played...
Backgammon. Yes. And then the next day it would be like, you know, a Drazi and something else. And the thing is, it was the same two guys. But it was always like different aliens every day. You know, we were just like rotating aliens. There was that, and then it was... And then there was a memory I have of, you know, Andreas in his sports car and full makeup with a cigarette hanging out of his mouth. You know, that was pretty much a daily, you know, you'd see that coming into the parking lot or leaving or whatever. And then my other favorite is actually Wayne Alexander and his interesting walk around the set costume as Laurien, which was basically his full-on makeup, long fingers, full-on shoes and boots, you know, which were like, you know, 3 inches tall or something, 4 inches tall. And then shorts and a T-shirt. That was really fun. And he used to come into the costume department and, you know, entertain us between things.
Now, there's a rumor out there that the episode where Zach is replacing Garibaldi as the... security chief, and the Minbari women are fitting him for the new black uniform, and he keeps getting stuck with the needles.
Uh-huh.
Were those women actually people from the costume department?
Yes.
And were you one of them?
Yes.
How did that happen?
That happened because basically Joe wrote the scene where he wanted a fitting. I don't know why he wrote the scene, but he came to, again, our designer, Ann, and said, I'm running a scene where, you know, Zach's being fitted for his new uniform, and I want all you girls to play the tailors. And I think he particularly wanted Ann to do it, but she's way too shy for that. And she was like, no, I'm not going to do it. So, but I did it.
Which one were you, Holly?
Oh, I was the sticker, of course.
Oh, yes.
I was the fitter because that's what I do. I mean, I was just doing my normal thing. I mean, that's what you saw me doing there is what I do normally. So, yeah, I was the fitter, and a couple of the other ladies from the department were the other ones in the background, sort of snickering and giggling, and yeah.
All right, so how was it for you to get into makeup?
It was much more trying than I thought it was going to be, and much more, I had a lot more sympathy for the background people after that. Let's put it that way. That makeup is very difficult to wear in terms of, my ears were totally covered up. I couldn't hear anything, and I had never done this kind of thing before, and so they, you know, they ran like a rehearsal, and Tony Dow is the director, and he's very sweet and very nice, and they said, okay, just pretend like you're fitting in, just do what you normally do, we're going to run the lines, and just, you know, and so I did, and then after that, they said, okay, now, repeat what you did before, exactly this in the same places. And I thought, oh, why didn't you tell me that before? For one, I have no idea what I did. I was just sort of doing my thing, you know. And plus, I couldn't hear. I couldn't hear the lines, really. So I was doing the best I could to sort of follow along, but I thought, oh, I hope I'm doing the right thing, because I have no idea what's going on. It was like I was underwater the whole time, and that was very frustrating.
So, Kim, do you have any other anecdotes about, I guess, Fitting some of the more famous guest stars on the show.
Famous guest stars. Oh, my goodness. Well, let's see.
Like Michael York's costume.
That's who came to mind immediately. I'm trying to remember if I was very involved with Michael York's original fittings. I don't think I was. But I was involved with his fittings later when he was actually on the set and working. And he was a very sweet, very dear man. He loved his costume. It weighed a ton. It was probably the heaviest costume we had on the whole show because it was real chainmail.
It was heavier than Kosh?
Jeffrey, but I think it probably was, yes.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. It was chain. We had it made at a shop in the L.A. area that does that kind of thing, and they did a beautiful job, and it was chainmail. It was all knitted, you know, for him and everything, and you know, put together, linked together. And it was very, very heavy. It took, like, 3 people to dress him. And he was very, very he was great about it. He was very sweet, and he loved it. And he asked Anne at the end for his, you know, rendering, and she gave it to him.
Wow.
And that's very, not very common. I don't think anyone else did that. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. He was very nice.
So did you have
anybody? I enjoyed that one very much.
Did you have anybody who was difficult that after you got them fit, you just sat there going, oh, I'm so glad that's over?
I didn't. I'm trying to think.
You are
no,
way
I mean, well, I'm trying to remember, and a few people would come in and, you know, and again, same problem. The Earth Force uniforms were not easy to fit. They took a lot of work, and for each person, they had to be really altered a lot to make them work properly. And some people just didn't get it, and they'd come in, and, you know, they'd be playing, you know, some random captain or, you know, whatever, I don't know. And we'd fit them in the uniform, and they'd, you know, not want to wear it and not like it. And I'm like, well, I'm sorry, but, you know, this is a uniform. This is it. You want to be on the show, here it is, you know. And that was pretty much that. Yeah. I can think of one person. I can't even remember his name, so I can't tell you. who was very uneven and, you know, gave me a really hard time, and I think I altered his pants about 4 times before he finally got to camera. Because he felt they didn't fit right. And I'm like, they're never going to see your pants, trust me. Everything's from the shoulders up. But yeah.
Anyway. Was there any costume that you worked on that was very difficult to put together, and in the process of doing it, you're like not so sure about it, but after you'd finished, you stepped back and were amazed that it had come together as well as it might have?
That I was not so sure about, and then it finally did come together?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, you were cutting out a little bit. So.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. While you're working on it, you're not so sure it's coming together, but then once you make the last stitch and you stand back and take a look at it, you go, oh, wow, this is really something else.
Let me think. Gosh, oh, if you have anything, Jeffrey, help me.
I was going to reverse the question. Are there ones where you thought you were on track and then either a director or JMS said, not so good?
Not so much.
Yeah.
No, we went through quite a few evolutions, I'm sure people noticed, of like the Drock, is it the Drock costume? Yeah, the Drock costume.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of kept changing, and I think everyone is having a hard time visualizing exactly what that was. And again, that went through, during that time when the Drock was first coming out, we probably went through 3 different designers too, so that probably didn't help. But it kept evolving and changing, and nobody could really decide what it was and what it wanted to be, and that was kind of frustrating. That was frustrating. The uniforms. Am I going out of bounds to start to talk about Crusade?
No,
not at all.
Oh, okay. The original uniforms for Crusades were difficult and frustrating too.
The bellhop costumes.
Yeah, exactly. Again, a different designer who I love and I think did a wonderful job when we got to the black ones, but I think I didn't have enough input on the first gray ones, and I think I could have and should have, and I sort of stepped back and let the designer and you know, Joe and John and everybody kind of figure out what it was, and I feel like later I should have had more input in terms of, you know, these really aren't going to work because, and I knew all the reasons, and I sort of held my tongue and stepped, you know, it wasn't my place at the time, I didn't think. And now I look back at it and go, I wish I would have said something then, because it kind of wasn't working.
Now, everybody should also know that your most recent credit is a big movie that's out right now, Deja Vu.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Ooh,
yeah, that's what I was in New Orleans doing. Yep.
Right.
Yep.
You have a long
more recently gotten
credit list.
What's that?
I say you have a long and impressive credit list.
I've been, yeah, kind of busy since Babylon 5, yeah. And some TV, some films. I worked on Deja Vu most recently. I worked on the X-Men 3 movie and The Island. How come I'm in the science fiction genre? What, I don't know what's that about.
Because they have the coolest costumes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Because you're working.
And the first Charlie's Angels movie. Not so much science fiction.
Depends on who you ask.
That's right.
Holly, what's your preference to work? Theater, television, or film?
Right now, I would say film. Right now, I'd say film, yeah. Theater, actually, from a creative point of view, of course, theater is always wonderful, but it's like, you know, there's no way I could have ever bought a house or done anything. It's strictly nonprofit, and it's strictly, if you want to do it for to be happy, that's great, but not to, you know, feed yourself.
Right.
And television is, it's exciting, and it can be fun. It's a lot. It's a lot of work, to be honest. In some ways, it's a lot more work than doing a film. I mean, when you think about it, you're doing, you know, 22 episodes same in 9 months, and you're maybe doing a film in, you know, 6 months. That's only 2 hours. So, I mean, it's really just a lot more work to do, especially something like Babylon 5 that's like an hour every week. You know, every 7 or 8 days, you know, you're shooting a whole new episode. It's really, really hard. So I may as well do a film, and, you know, so not quite so stressful and pays a little more.
Well, I really hope that I hope that we get a chance to do the roundtable discussion as you suggested, and if not, we're going to get some of the other girls on here so that they can dish on you.
Oh, that'd be great. I think you need to, because they have much more interesting story than I do, I'm sure.
I want to thank you very much for joining us tonight, though. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah,
that was,
you're very welcome.
It was a lot of fun.
You learned something. Yes. I don't know.
Well, you're very welcome. The podcast, you know that part of what we do is to let the fans of the show know what went on behind the scenes, what went on in creating the show that we love.
Yeah.
So, you know, your stories are wonderful to hear as much as anybody else's.
Oh, thanks. That's why I was trying to think of things like, what was my favorite? What was my least favorite? Boy.
All right, kiddo. Thank you so very much. Really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. But I do have to tell you, Jeffrey.
What's that?
That I have to give you a little bit of a hard time. Are you still there?
Yeah.
Because I'm here home sipping my Cosmopolitan, you know, practically alone, as it were. And I know when you did Wayne, you know, you were here in person feeding him wine. So I'm feeling a little slighted that way, okay?
That's very fair.
Next
I can
time.
Tell you a drink or two. Yeah, exactly.
All right,
you,
then.
The right one.
Okay.
Oh, that's great.
Thank you,
all right.
Kim.
Very nice. Nice meeting you all over the phone.
This is Bob. Before, Bob relied on the internet to enhance his geek status. After using Technorama for natural geek enhancement, Bob is rolling his 20-sided die, reciting Holy Grail lines, and answering Star Trek trivia with the best of them. And he has a happy missus at the home, too. Technorama for natural geek enhancement. Only available at ChuckChat.com.
Like a butterfly, she changes. I sit and wait. Prophecy unwinds.
Ah, yes. Our haiku rejoiner.
I need some tea.
That's another one of Hillary Giffen's marvelous haikus.
Nice.
Very nice.
So haikus will be our new voicemail segment listener feedback intro.
Sure, why not?
Can I do that?
What the heck?
Yeah.
You bet.
I think that's a plan.
I'm playing the part of Jeffrey tonight.
So. And you're the understudy?
Yeah, that's it. Jeffrey had to bail. He had to go in do editing. So.
Something you understand quite well.
I understand very well.
All right, well, let's jump right into our voicemail.
Hey, Suburb Tim and Jeffrey, this is Trampus Whiteman from The Signal. Just wanted to call in response to, I believe it was episode 42, you mentioned how in a Star Wars versus Babylon 5 duel, how Star Wars had no telepaths. That's not exactly true from a certain point of view. After all, the Jedi are, by nature, part telepathic and part telekinetic. I could also envision a discussion between Darth Vader and the Shadows going like this. Shadows would start out and they would say, "We are the power of the dark side." And Darth Vader would say, "I command the power of the dark side." To which the Shadows would reply, "Oh, patty cakes. Stay shiny. Talk to you later. Bye."
That was a long way to go for that.
Okay. I never considered the Jedi telepathic.
They see the future. Yeah.
Well, that's not telepathy.
Well, they sense it though, and while they have the ability to
empathic.
And they have a small ability to influence. Well, the Force gives them power over weak minds.
Right.
But that
which is half the planet, so that covers pretty much everyone.
But that's more.
All right, never mind. Point made.
That's more persuading people who are suggestible. That's not telepathy.
Right.
They're not.
Right, because if you remember, it didn't work on Watto.
It didn't work on Jabba.
Right.
Right.
Oh, oh, oh.
Go ahead, say it. You're dying to.
He's not a Jedi.
There we go. So, there were some.
I think that's more like Jabba's brother Pizza.
Oh, dude. Whoa. Next voicemail.
No, hang on. I want to know what's the level of geeky inside of Star Wars on that. Does Jabba have his own language? Do people speak Jabba?
The Hutts,
well, I don't think
language.
People speak Klingon. I don't think
do they have a dictionary?
I don't know if there's an actual dictionary, but there are people who can speak several of the languages that were spoken on screen.
Oh.
Wow.
Get a good 3PO unit and you can have a droid who's fluent in over several million languages. That's no big deal. I am not impressed.
Oh, I feel so low on the geek poll.
This is Jarsto from the Netherlands with an early response for episode 44. Well, it seems I'm now attracting voicemails. In response to one of those, I'd like to point out that I haven't been engaged in a voicemail filibuster. Though the word is oddly fitting, deriving through French and Spanish from Dutch vrijbuiter, the more immediate English translation being freebooter, a filibuster in the intended political sense of the word has certain requirements that this situation does not fit. For one thing, there is no rule of order allowing me unlimited speaking time. As a rule, I actually work quite hard to keep these voicemails under a minute, or at least under 90 seconds. Which also means this can't be a filibuster, because a filibuster means trying to delay the actual business of government by using, or if you will, abusing, the right to unlimited speaking time. Obviously, I once contributed to this inadvertently in the impromptu voicemail show, but it's certainly never been my intention to sabotage the actual show. Also, in response to another voicemail, I would certainly say Mike is the fourth member of the team. I'm fifth, at best. Now on to the actual episode and the deep geeking. Because of the length of this voicemail, I limit myself to one point. I don't think that it's unrealistic for the Shadows to run over a Star Fury and keep going. They've been careful not to leave witnesses, but in all those cases, they were doing a specific operation that had to remain hidden for some reason. Just destroying a random alien ship, and maybe causing some chaos and confusion, would actually play into their hands when there isn't some big reason to remain hidden. Also, the rumors that are starting to spread clearly indicate that they have left witnesses before. This situation is no different.
Okay, well, first of all, Yarsto, that voice message was 1 minute and 39 seconds, so you exceeded your 90-second time limit.
Don't worry about it. I've got something. I'll take care of it in post. It'll be fun.
Oh, there we go. Got to compress him so he sounds like Mickey Mouse. Awesome.
Well, actually, I was going to comment on that. He stopped using his noise reduction. He doesn't sound like he's on another planet anymore.
That's
which
good.
I'm not sure. Well, I don't know. I kind of like that about him. It's kind of nice.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
Well, we can have him experiment. Go back and forth.
There we go.
Yeah. Every other paragraph.
I meant between messages, dude.
Oh, okay.
well, to more trivial matters, he makes an interesting point about the Star Fury Shadow collision, and I would buy it up to a point, except that they come back and do it again.
Well, it was fun the first time.
Even if it's different, well, I know, right, exactly. Even if it's a different ship, dude, I just smashed into a small spaceship. Rare, dude, on this hyperspace route, man. Oh, wow, there it is. I mean, you'd think, even if the fact that they might be becoming more bold and revealing their presence.
It's like throwing a beach ball in a dolphin pool. That's what it is.
Right, exactly. That's exactly right.
I still
that's
think
a very good analogy.
I still think that he just happened to be a speck in a shipping lane and was being ignored. Referring back, oh my goodness, there's a Hungarian website that has a Huttis phrase book.
I knew that somebody had to.
Someone in the chat room sent me a link, and
not even an English Huttis, it's Hungarian Huttis.
See, well, I need that.
You remember the
he has it
you
in,
remember the Monty Python sketch with the Hungarian English dictionary?
Oh geez, yeah. But no, the website has a Hungarian domain name. But it's in English.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
Oh, I need that because I got the voice for that one. Ho, 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 ho. Too dumb. I gotta speak Java.
It's a phrase book. There's a phrase. Next voice book.
Next voice book. Just
run away.
This is Jarsto from the Netherlands with another Babylon 5 haiku in honor of the latest bout of deep geeking. Purple, must fight, green. Equal, opposite, response. Green, must fight, purple.
Wow.
Okay.
Actually, in all fairness, Jarsto had sent that some time ago and I lost it. And they resend it, and it was just too good to let it go away without sharing it with everyone.
Now you don't need to be messing with our producer. He'll take away your holiday time.
Our benevolent overlord. All right, is that it for the
that's
voicemail?
It for the voicemails. Okay. It's all you for how many emails do we have?
I've got three, but they're fairly short.
Okay.
Actually, two. I'll take that back. Here we go. This comes from Gabriel Hardman. Says, I have to disagree with Tim on the myth versus sci-fi topic. He stated that Babylon 5 was more hard sci-fi than Star Trek because the technology of B5 could work in the real world. On the contrary, the themes of B5, the big story, is much more on the myth side. The shadows and Vorlons, etc. There is a huge debt in B5 to Tolkien and the Lord of the Rings books, almost to the point of pastiche. While the workable tech is cool and helps enormously to ground the show, you don't tell stories about cool ships and weapons. The tech in Star Trek may be less plausible, but Star Trek is a show that's less about people and more about using big sci-fi ideas to make moral points. Don't think I'm putting down either of these shows. As my DVD shelf attests, I'm a huge nerd for both of them. I'm just trying to frame them in the myth versus sci-fi debate. I'd call in next time, but I doubt I could compete with a superstar that is Jarsto. Well, I had sent back Gabriel a response saying, please call in. Don't worry about Jarsto. We'll handle Jarsto.
Yeah.
As anyone can. I think that Gabriel might have misinterpreted part of my what I was trying to say in terms of science fiction and Babylon 5 as compared to Star Trek. Obviously, both shows at their best were about stories and ideas and character and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that, well, let me rephrase that. The thing that makes Babylon 5 work so much better is that because they had the giant overall five-year arc, they could tell stories, the majority of which were more about character
and big ideas and mythology and that sort of stuff. Whereas Star Trek didn't really have that, so you had a larger share of episodes where the problem was had to do with the antimatter generator breaking down, and so they had to reverse the chronoton field in order to set everything right again.
Yeah, basically, in Star Trek, more often than not, they would fall back, the technology would become the story, whereas in Babylon 5, the characters and the story came first. The technology was just part of the setting.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, Enterprise was a character as much as any of the characters.
And the station isn't?
Well, and the station is as well. I mean, but it's not
No, I mean, the difference is, though, is that
no, I take that
back.
Enterprise
is a character.
Yeah, no, so I disagree. I don't think the Babylon 5 station was a character at all. I think it was just the setting. Because you did not have entire overarching storylines or stories that that involved the day-to-day operations or the technical details of the station like you did with the Enterprise. The Enterprise, every show, something happened to the ship, we have to fix the ship.
Right. And in the context of that, it works to a certain degree. Is workable because what you're doing is you're setting up a mythology and a framework within the Star Trek universe. Okay? This is how it works in the Star Trek universe. But that does not necessarily have to correspond with the reality of the real world. Now, you can argue in Babylon 5, well, hyperspace is sort of stretching the idea of it, but, you know, not necessarily either. You know, there's certain physics that allow for it. Right now, there are no physics that allow for warp drive. And there's, you know, we haven't discovered the chronoton or the Verderon ray or any of that kind of stuff. On Babylon 5, the story was about, first and foremost, the big tale that was being told. And having said that, the few stories that are on Babylon 5 that deal with technology going wrong, like a distant star, they're not that compelling a story.
Well, and they seem to get lost in the actual characters that are involved with it as well. So it's not really about the technology. It's about how the people are handling the situation where the technology is taking over.
Right. And to be fair, the best Star Trek episodes are ones where that's not the issue. It's not the issue of how do we fix the double talk generators. It's Kirk has to make a decision. Or if Picard does this, then something else happens. Is that what you really want to have happen?
Or where it's off the ship altogether. One of the best episodes of Next Gen was when Picard got hit with the probe and he lived that entire lifetime inside of the probe in a matter of minutes. That was a brilliant episode.
Right, fantastic. Exactly.
And it took it completely outside of the Star Trek universe. It completely took it off the ship. Had nothing to do with the technology other than the little header and tail in order to make it, you know, part of Next Gen.
Well, you're in for a treat, Mike, because as Babylon 5 rolls on, it, especially once you hit the third and fourth years.
I'm halfway through third already.
Okay, well, then you're already seeing it where the station is not really the focus anymore. It's you're going places. You're going to Narn, and you're going to Minbar, and you're going to Centauri Prime and Zahadum. You know, if you go to Zahadum, you will die. You know that, don't you?
I've heard that before.
Okay, just making sure. That's, you know.
Remember that phrase. Sure. Just hold on to that, okay?
Got it.
All right, one more email here. This is from Miles Collins. Dear Summer, Tim, Jeffrey, and Michael, just a short note about the comments on Technomages in show number 43. Liking science-based stories rather than fantasy, I felt the same as Tim when I watched B5 the first time around. But reading the Technomage trilogy by Gene Cavalos changed this. Not only does it explain what the Technomages were doing on Babylon 5 at the time of the events in Geometry of Shadows, it also put a different emphasis on the tech in Technomage. If you haven't read the novels, do. Thanks for the podcast. Greeting from Lübeck, Germany. Well, I responded to Miles. I had avoided those novels mostly because I just don't have a good taste in my mouth for Technomages, but I think I might have to change that and find those suckers and read them now.
You're not a Technomage fan?
He was
not. No, the Technomages, other than it took Crusade and Galen and some of the things he did for me to warm up to the concept, but for the most part, nope, Technomages just don't do it for me. Sorry, guys.
Okay, well,
and now you have to go find those books, which are out of print.
Yeah, I know, right? And that's the fun, you know. Yeah, what can I say?
I have one comment from the feedback in show 44. Kurt, our good friend Kurt from the Scapecast, has submitted another B5 seasonal music selection for us to try out. He says, here's some seasonal music for our Centauri friends. Silent Narn.
Oh, God.
Holy Narn.
Okay.
We're just going to have to go through. It's like...
Jingle Kosh.
Malari's Quake at the Site or something. And we'll just have to work on that.
There's lots of them. I think we should put together a compilation. Let's put together the B5 Christmas compilation.
I have to put a collection together of all the B5 seasonal deviations.
I had one roll into my head that was based on the Grandma Got Run Over by a Vorlon.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
Grandma
no.
Got Run Over by a Vorlon walking home from grade 17. You may say there's no such thing as first ones. But as for me and Susan, we believe.
Oh, no, nice.
Oh, nice.
Nice.
Damn, I even know what that means. I must be catching up. I've been catching up.
Nice.
This show actually makes sense. Might have to actually hang around and listen to it now.
We have enlightened another. Yay.
Oh, that's good. Yeah.
So is that it?
That's it.
That's it. That's all I've got.
That's all we have
for
today.
You're done.
Well, thank everybody for being on the show.
Whoa, that was loud.
A little bit loud.
Kim Holly for being with us.
Yes, thank you, Kim. And if you want to join in with the fun that is our voicemail line, you can call that line at 206-338-2259, 206-338-2259.
The year the Great War came upon us all.
Or you can send us an email at babylonpodcast@gmail.com. We'll see you next time on the other side of the gate.